Hey, good virtual morning. Welcome to The Other Animals for March, Friday the 13th, 2020. It happens to be show number 45. I'm your host, Laurent Levy, and no, it's not virtual. I'm really here. Yeah, so I actually physically came down to the studio. Crazy, huh? But, you know, in this weird balancing act that we're in the middle of right now, it seems we're all contending between doing the responsible thing and confronting, yes, coronavirus on the one hand, and on the other, trying to talk about pretty much anything else. I have to admit, there's a really big part of me that wants to come down hard on the side of the ladder. I mean, it's absolutely historic in terms of a global response. I've never seen anything like it. I don't believe anyone else has. I mean, is it precautionary to an extreme, or is it just extreme? I was considering trying to get through the whole show without mentioning it at all, providing something of a one-hour respite from the subject, but clearly that's not going to be possible. But it did get me thinking about, crazy of all things, our relationship with non-humans. Now, let's be absolutely clear. There's no one on any side of the spectrum that sees the virus as a life worthy of consideration, and there's no one who would mourn the destruction of the virus. It's not, as Jane Desmond discussed a few weeks ago, a, quote, grievable life. But have you read about how this damn thing works? Listen, this is the New York Times. The virus enters the body through the nose, mouth, or eyes, then attaches to cells in the airways that produce a protein called ACE2. The virus infects the cell by fusing its oily membrane with the membrane of the cell. Once inside, the coronavirus releases a snippet of genetic material called RNA. The virus's genome is less than 30,000 genetic letters long, whereas ours is over 3 billion. The infected cell reads the RNA and begins making proteins that will keep the immune system at bay and help assemble new copies of the virus. So this thing has the ability to trick the host cell into beating its own defenses. As the infection progresses, the machinery of the cell begins to churn out new spikes and other proteins that will form more copies of the coronavirus. Each infected cell can release millions of copies of the virus before the cell finally breaks down and dies. The virus may infect nearby cells or end up in droplets that escape the lungs. All right, so much for not talking about coronavirus. Now, I don't know about you, but all that sounds like purposefulness. Was that what you might call it? It's intentional. It's planned. It's almost too diabolical to be accidental. It's almost intelligent. And I think that intelligence threatens and terrifies us like absolutely no other organism on Earth does. Viruses, it seems, are the only non-humans that we can't control. Think about some of the relationships we've talked about here already. Our companion animals, dogs and cats and rabbits, obviously we control those. We control fish and aquatic animals by the trillions, even though we can't control their environment, at least not yet. We certainly control our so-called livestock animals, in fact, every aspect of their lives, from procreation and birth all the way through death. Now, it's true we don't completely control insects, but we're doing a pretty good job decimating some of their populations nonetheless, and beekeeping, for all of its benign appearances, is essentially a form of robbery. Yes, I believe you would be very hard-pressed to find a single example of a relationship we have with any non-human that does not involve, in some way or another, a degree of control. But is that necessarily always a bad thing? Are we just control freaks at heart? Can control, in some examples, be mutually beneficial? One of the basic ways we control non-humans is by population control. We touched a nerve here a few months ago when we considered not spaying or neutering our pets, considering perhaps our interference with the natural processes of, say, the dogs. It may be good for us on the macro level, but is it necessarily good for the natural tendency of the individual canine? Well, it's one thing for companion animals, but there are whole other considerations when it comes to wildlife. And today we'll be talking with Stephanie Boyles Griffin of the Botstiber Institute and the intriguing challenge of wildlife population management today on The Other Animals. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, let's start where it all started. We got to go to China. China's interest is not what you think. China's interest in the vegan Just Egg and other plant-based protein increases in response to, yes, the coronavirus outbreak. So this came from Bloomberg.com. San Francisco food manufacturing company, Just, which is the producer of the Just Egg, that's J-U-S-T, is fielding increased inquiries from Chinese state-backed companies seeking animal-free protein sources amidst the coronavirus outbreak. Though Just CEO Josh Tetrick declined to name the companies, he said that authorities are trying to think about how to reduce the risk of future outbreaks by curbing China's reliance on meat from confined animals. The country's wet markets, where freshly slaughtered, unpackaged meat is sold, have been identified as a possible source of the deadly outbreak that's claimed more than almost 3,200 lives in China and disrupted businesses worldwide. Quote, some of the biggest companies, larger food manufacturers, including some that are backed by state government, are proactively reaching out to me personally, our executive team, our board, and the team in China about now wanting to partner, he said in an interview. China's producers are viewing the current climate as a time for more quality-controlled food. Prior to the outbreak, China was already experiencing protein shortages caused by the spread of African swine fever and its impact on pork supplies. The country is viewed as a major growth market for plant-based protein producers, including Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat. Spokeswoman for Impossible Foods reiterated the company's goal is to be in China as soon as possible, saying that it already started the approval process with China's FDA for its products. Impossible Foods plans to expand into China is unrelated to the virus outbreak, which is the latest public health crisis due to use of animals in the food chain, the spokeswoman said. Very, very interesting. I don't know, would you call that opportunistic or just an inevitable progression? That'd be a good one to follow. All right, next one comes from the UK. This is actually a couple weeks I've been trying to get to this story, but the UK is planning a vote that will ban trophy hunting. Trophy hunting has driven many wild animals closer and closer to extinction, such as African elephants and leopards. This comes from The Guardian. According to Metro UK, a UK ban on trophy hunting would save the lives of 2,000 wild animals over the next decade. Because of so much concern over the topic, ministers launched a consultation asking for the public's opinion on the ban. Eduardo Goncalves, he's founder of the Campaign Against Trophy Hunting, told Metro UK that the most popular animals killed by British trophy hunters are hippos, lions, zebras, polar bears, and monkeys. The majority of the UK population already disagrees with trophy hunting, so the public being able to give their opinion on the topic may actually result in a ban. Celebrities like Ricky Gervais were also trying to urge fellow UK residents to vote against trophy hunting and make their opinion heard. So that's one we'll also follow up on that. All right, last one. We come back home, sort of, to the great state of Idaho. Idaho has made an agreement that restricts wolf killing and bans the use of indiscriminate M44 cyanide bombs. I don't know. All right, listen to this one. In a key victory for wildlife, conservation groups finalized an agreement yesterday that sets strict limits on how and where a federal agency can kill wolves in Idaho. It bans the use of M44 cyanide bombs statewide and prohibits the use of snares to kill wolves on public lands. The new restrictions on wolf snares and the M44 ban will remain in place until the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services completes a detailed analysis on the environmental impact of killing wolves. Quote, cyanide bombs and traps are vicious and indiscriminate, said Andrea Santosier, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, in a statement. This victory is a step forward in reducing the suffering of animals at the hands of our federal government. About 3 years ago, a young boy named Canyon Mansfield, he was 14 at the time, and when an M44 device near his home exploded, killing his dog and injuring him, the boy. The device was set illegally and without proper signage on public lands within a quarter mile of Mansfield's neighborhood in Pocatello, Idaho. Mansfield stated, the news is very uplifting because it shows progress in our fight for justice for Casey, which is his dog, and everyone else who has suffered from these cyanide bombs. I believe this shows that we are fighting a battle with victory in sight. The settlement also blocks wildlife services from targeting wolves in wilderness areas throughout Idaho. It requires strict limitations on the use of snares and traps, banning the use of snares targeting wolves, and requiring offset jaws and pan tensions that cannot be triggered by smaller animals. Now here's the quote. It's a shame that it took the poisoning of a child and the killing of a beloved family dog to get wildlife services to put the brakes on M44 deployment in Idaho. said Brooks Fahey, executive director of Predator Defense. Under this settlement, the tentative moratorium on M44s in Idaho is locked in, at least until the agency completes a full EIS. We need to ban these indiscriminate poison landmines nationwide before there are more victims. Boy, doesn't that say anything, right? It doesn't matter. You can keep going, but it took it had to hit home before some action was taken. All right, that might make a nice follow-up to our first guest. And when we return, we will be talking with Stephanie Boyles Griffin of the Botstiber Institute, and we're going to take a look at this whole issue of wildlife fertility control. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
A little bit of Beethoven in the pastoral setting to get us going here. All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. We're talking, we're going to be meeting with Stephanie Boyles Griffin. She serves as the Science and Policy Director for the Botstiber Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control. The Institute aims to advance the use of effective, sustainable fertility control methods to mitigate human-wildlife conflicts and promote coexistence worldwide. She's also the senior scientist for the Wildlife Protection Department at the Humane Society of the United States, where she works with teams responsible for promoting humane, innovative, and sustainable wildlife management policies, practices, and procedures. She has worked with federal and state agencies, non-governmental agencies, municipalities, corporations, and communities to develop and implement humane, sustainable wildlife management policies and programs. In 2011, Stephanie was appointed by Governor Martin O'Malley to serve as a commissioner on the Maryland Wildlife Advisory Commission. She's also served on steering committees for the International Conference on Ecology and Transportation and the Human-Wildlife Conflict Collaboration. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lawrence. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I'm not sure where to start, but I think it might be, you know, when we hear about wildlife management, we don't know what it means. So I wonder if you could just give us really foundational, what are some of the issues with overpopulation? If we didn't do anything, if we had nothing, if there was no wildlife management, what are some of the things that happen when there is a wildlife overpopulation challenge to the humans?
So to start, a lot of people use the term overpopulation when we're talking about resolving human-wildlife conflicts. And in some cases, there are overabundant populations of animals that need to be managed in some way. But in a lot of cases, it's not that animals are overpopulated. It's that humans are expanding and degrading habitat, and they're also separating habitat from, you know, it's not contiguous anymore. And when that happens, when human populations decrease, when urbanization expands, conflicts between humans and wildlife grow exponentially. And so when that happens, traditionally, over the years, people have resolved these conflicts using things like what you were talking about in the news segment. They use toxicants, they use firearms, they can use really horrible and cruel traps. But in many situations, especially now in this day and age, society's attitudes and values towards wildlife and how we manage them are starting to change. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it's becoming either logistically unfeasible for human health and safety reasons, or it's illegal, as it's become in Idaho, to use M44s, for instance, or it's socially and politically unacceptable to use these traditional methods anymore. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, we're learning that these traditional methods ultimately aren't even effective, because for animals like deer, when you remove a small proportion of the population in response to people complaining about them, it causes what we call compensatory reproduction. It causes a bounce back effect where you not only regain the population of animals you have in a very short period of time because it causes reproduction to accelerate, you may even have more. Mm-hmm. So that's true of deer, that's true of coyotes out west, even coyotes here in the east. It's a very well established phenomenon. So for those reasons, researchers in the late 20th century, they began exploring the possibility of mitigating these conflicts by using fertility control as one component of a comprehensive, holistic conflict management program. And I say, you know, comprehensive because fertility control is only one part of a conflict mitigation plan. Mm-hmm. We really encourage people to use any form of population management to mitigate conflict as a method of last resort, because most conflicts are site-specific. And what I mean by that is, for instance, with deer, most of the time people are complaining about deer eating ornamental landscape, right? Foraging mm-hmm. on ornamental landscape. Mm-hmm. And really the best way to mitigate that, because you can have that damage whether you have 5 deer or 50 in your neighborhood, the best way to mitigate that is to use strategic fencing, repellents, all kinds of different site-specific mitigation measures to protect your property, which is much faster for you to do yourself than waiting for a municipality to decide or your community to decide that it's going to manage the population.
So in an example like that, with, say, the deer, that doesn't mm-hmm. sound like that's not necessarily, you're starting to say that that's not a numbers issue. That's not, like you said, it could be 5 deer, it could be 5,000.
It's not density dependent.
It's
exactly.
Not density
it's
dependent,
not density
right?
dependent.
It's a behavioral thing. Like, we don't want, I mean, we have it around us, rabbits eating, you know, eating, getting into our, that, but we're not going to, good luck trying to, you know, rabbits. But, right? But I'm thinking, just to go back to the basis, the it sounded like you were suggesting that the that there's an idea of encroachment, but who's encroaching on who? Like if there's urban right. sprawl, if humans are building out their you know, building out their communities, and we're going into areas that were once, you know, wild, where like right, in other words, who's encroaching on who? It's not necessarily that they're right. coming into our space. Some of the issue is related to our own is urban sprawl the right word, right?
Right.
That's in play though, right? In terms of just understanding the whole situation.
So if we're talking about the East, and I don't want to make it sound like this applies to everywhere, but let's talk about the East for instance. Mm-hmm. And most of urban development occurs on areas that used to be farm acreage, right?
Yeah.
And that's edge effect, you know, that's intrinsically attractive to deer. And yet we go in, the farmers sell this land, developers develop it and build houses there. The deer are already there.
Yeah.
That was prime deer habitat because you've got edge all the way around those former farmlands, right?
What does that
so
mean?
The deer were already there.
Edge
effect, there are a lot of animals, including deer and rabbits, and a lot of animals that tend to spend their days in areas that are wooded where they feel protected during the day, and they tend to spend most of their time being active at night. So deer are crepuscular, which means they're really active at dusk and dawn, mm-hmm. and then you've got animals that are only active at night. That edge area, you'll see it's when you see deer coming out at dusk and feeding in a large vacant lot or a fallow farm crop area, you know, that is an edge animal going out of
okay.
an area where they spend most of the day. So that's what we kind of talk to ecologists are referring to as edge. But that's prime habitat for them. So that's where we put a lot of new development, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
The deer were already there when we put the houses in. And then they're adapting to what we're doing to change the landscape. And they do that very well. A lot of animals do that very well.
They're very adaptive.
Deer do it very well. Very, yeah. very adaptive.
Yeah. And it's you know, that's an interesting aspect. Is their adaptability is from a developmental, evolutionary. That's where I couldn't get the word. Mm-hmm. From an evolutionary perspective, that's their whole, that's why they've been so successful, is because they, absolutely, because of their adaptability. And when we have these situations where there is encroachment, I keep using that word, it's like we're using that adaptability against them somehow. It's like this thing that has been so beneficial for them throughout their span has now become a counterproductive thing. And it seems like we're turning that on its ear. Like our response to that adaptability is ultimately harmful to them. It's like it's turning what was a benefit into a problem.
Well, the other thing we do is we unknowingly invite them into our neighborhoods by making them so overwhelmingly attractive to them, they have no choice. Because we're, even though that edge habitat that they were living in was really optimal for them, we make it even better by putting in irrigation systems and planting grass. We build golf courses. We put in public parks that are irrigated and we're planting grass on them. Then we plant pansies and chrysanthemums and all kinds of things that they have access to that are like candy to them. And so what we try to emphasize first, before we even start talking about fertility control, is we ask people what the conflict is, because the solution really depends on what the conflict is. If the conflict is the animal is eating pansies, then you need to protect the pansies, or you need to plant something that's just as beautiful as a pansy, but that will be deer resistant to them. They don't have a liking for it, like a marigold or something like that. So that's the first line, is to determine that. But if it really is a population issue, then that's when we start talking about how to, first of all, use site-specific mitigation strategies to the greatest extent that we can for a period of time and make sure everybody in the community is using them. And then if there still appears to be a level of conflict that's above the social carrying capacity for that community, then we start talking about population management issues. But it really is the last thing we talk about, especially for an animal like deer, because site-specific mitigation measures are really, should always be the first thing to be done.
That's really interesting. We're sort of going on the premise. We've accepted the premise that there is conflict, right? There is this conflict exists. But there are degrees of conflict. You said level of conflict, like there is a certain tolerance. I'm guessing before you get a call, right? Something has, there's a tipping point that says, okay, this is no longer a manageable situation. We'll talk about that a second. If you're like, when does that tipping point hit usually? Are there times? Go ahead.
It changes from community to community, and it really has a lot more to do with the cultural values and attitudes that people have towards wildlife in general than it does biological carrying capacity, because rarely are we working in a situation where these animals have exceeded biological carrying capacity. As I just said, by enhancing these areas that they used to live in, we are by definition expanding the carrying capacity that land has for deer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not unusual for the population to go up when you do that, because there are no predators around them. Typically, hunting isn't allowed in those areas, and it's neither is it wanted. That's why people are living there, that a lot of people go there so that they can enjoy deer and not, be concerned about people using firearms or archery equipment to manage them in any way. But some of their neighbors don't share that view. And so often it's a cultural carrying capacity issue. And it's also people not getting along with each other about deer rather than really trying to resolve conflicts with deer themselves. As I said, site-specific mitigation measures really are key, but when people can't get along and decide within their community on how best to implement a framework for managing deer in their community, that's where we come in. When people cannot agree on a path forward, that's often when people call the Humane Society of the United States, our Urban Wildlife Program, or they call the Botstever Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control.
But the conflict, the conflict when it hits that point is between the humans, when they can't agree on when it's enough.
Yeah, because when a community is in has a consensus on what the path forward should be, and there's no strife between humans about on what to do about the deer, Generally, we don't get a call. It's usually when there is about 50% that want to use traditional lethal methods and 50% that want to do something different, and that's usually when we get the call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, there's such an I know I definitely want to talk about the methods because I know that that's really critical, but I'm just there is this sort of underlying ethical question, and maybe ethical is too strong a word. That, well, we're there, or they were there, you know, they were there mm-hmm. first. It's kind of what you're implying. And so we come along, who are we to say, oh, you know, now, like you say, they're eating our pansies or whatever, and we've got to do something about this. It's a problem, and it becomes their problem, where in fact, you know, we have actually, the human component has actually caused this problem. Right? They've actually, the issue has come from, you know, from us. And so why, there's a sense of what's the word, entitlement, that we're allowed to go to take action and deal with it. Does that come up?
we definitely have people on different, there will be various different stakeholders within a community, whether it's a small community or a municipality, a township, a county. And there are a lot of people that do hold that view. But ultimately, we are encouraging everyone to coexist, not just with the deer, but with each other. We're really trying to build communities and make them better. But when at the time that we get the call, they are polarized and they're really going at each other. And so, you know, you've got this human dimension going on that started with the deer, but there's more to it than that. People have they identify with their worldview on a lot of things, but they certainly identify with their worldview on where wildlife fits into everything. And it's when their identities are being attacked by somebody that they live in the same community with over this issue that these things become extremely volatile. And so we're really trying to diffuse the situation by getting everybody to talk to each other and not shout at each other. And come to them with some very real, sensible solutions that they can implement now and work with them to build from the ground up with a lot of stakeholder engagement, a conflict mitigation plan that they can develop together and then implement together, which may or may not involve population control and may or may not involve fertility control, frankly, because we want to start with the most non-intrusive methods possible, and then only use population management as a method of last resort, even if it's fertility control.
Is it fair to say that the basic level of that conflict is you kind of have two camps? One is saying there's lethal management, and the other side is saying non-lethal. In other words, one side is saying let's go hunting. Let's cull, our favorite word. Is that kind of where it starts?
I would say there are three, actually. Uh-huh. It's what's the problem? We've got other things that we need to deal with in the community. Mm-hmm. This is not a big deal to us. And then you've got people that are gung-ho about doing something non-lethal, that are really gung-ho about fertility control. They've actually hopped over the site-specific mitigation measures and gone quickly to fertility control. That's our solution. And then you've got the other camp that thinks only lethal methods will solve their problem. And that's where we have to come in and first go, okay, let's make sure we've actually used some common sense methods to resolve your conflicts by first identifying what those conflicts are and not assuming we know what they are. Mm-hmm. So start with what the conflict is and then start working with them to develop a plan that addresses the conflicts that have been identified through this external stakeholder engagement process.
It's interesting because when we think of wildlife, I was actually surprised that a lot of what you're doing is in this situation where you have some sort of an encroachment, you've got some sort of a human population that is being bothered by the wildlife, right? And that science seems to be a large part of your work. There's this other component, though, or maybe there isn't, where you're dealing with wildlife that is not... This is not necessarily around a human population. Is mm-hmm. I'm thinking, are you in areas like, you know, the national parks or anything like that, where there is another issue with wildlife overpopulation that you may or may not have been called on to help mitigate? Is that ever part of your work?
Yes. So in some situations, and I'm thinking more outside the United States than within. So for instance, we just hosted a symposium at the Pathways Human Dimensions Conference in Kenya. Our team with Humane Society International works with a bunch of different stakeholders and game reserve managers to use a fertility control vaccine called PZP, porcine zona pellucida, to manage African elephant populations, because game reserves in South Africa are closed systems. Even though they're very large, they're still fenced. And so there's only so much biological carrying capacity within that fenced area for an animal as large and that can reproduce as quickly over time as an African elephant. Mm-hmm. So they have to limit population growth in order to keep the herd healthy and the land healthy.
I was going to ask about that later, because that's almost counterintuitive. You would think, first of all, you wouldn't think that an elephant could reproduce quickly.
Generally, just because they're really good moms. The matriarch is really good at protecting the herd of their young, but also the mothers themselves. So unless the animal is born with some sort of defect, the infant survival rate is very high. They don't reproduce quickly. And, you know, one cow is only going to have a calf maybe once every 3 or 4 years, but that calf has a very good chance of surviving. And therefore, over time, over time, we're talking decades, but still, because these are closed systems and they want these animals to remain healthy and they want the land to remain healthy, we have to have some form. And so you try to use the least invasive method that you can, which in this case just involves darting the animal once a year if you want them to be infertile. If you don't want them to be infertile, you can reverse the process by just not treating them, and they will regain fertility within a year or so.
Interesting.
So it's reversible. It's just a dart. So we're not having to capture and restrain mm-hmm. them or anything like that in the case of African elephants. And then if we want to reverse it, we can. And it doesn't have any impact on their social or reproductive behavior. If they're already pregnant, which they usually are when we treat them the first time, it doesn't have any detrimental impact on the growing fetus.
Interesting. So, all right. I definitely want to get more into the methods when we come back after the break. We do have to take a quick break.
Sure.
We'll be right back. We're talking with Stephanie Boyles-Griffin of the Botstieber Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
It shouldn't happen to man's best friend, but it does. Take a drive down a country road or a city street and you'll see them. Dogs left to spend their entire lives in solitary confinement, trapped at the end of a chain or inside a small pen. There's no crueler punishment for these social pack animals who need and deserve love, companionship, scratches behind the ears, and walks around the block. Please let your dogs live inside. Make them part of the family. For more information, visit PETA.org.
She ran
We're back on The Other Animals. A little pick wildfire because of horses. I don't know. It's the best I can.
Yeah.
We're talking with Stephanie Boyles-Griffin of the Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control. Before we get back, Stephanie, just have I would have had two announcements. I have one now because one of the announcements had to do with the 2020 Peaceable Kingdom Conference that was scheduled. to be in Bucks County Community College April 18th, and because of our favorite subject of the day, it has been postponed likely until the fall. So if you were planning on going to that event, that has now been postponed. However, as far as we know, as of the current time, there are vegan Passover Seders that are scheduled around the country. These are sponsored by Jewish Veggies. I'm going to give you a couple of these. The one here in Philadelphia is still on, at least at the moment, Monday, April 6th. It's going to be at the Ethical Society in Rittenhouse Square. We've got one that's scheduled to be in New York. That one is still on at the moment. It's Monday, April 13th, Congregation Road of Shalom in Washington. That's in New York, sorry. And in Washington, also on the 13th, at the 6th and I Synagogue. Also one in Los Angeles, Sunday, April 5th, at Beth Chaim Chadishim, 6090 West Pico Boulevard, if I'm pronouncing that correct. Ticket and additional information at jewishveg.org. So far, like I say, right now they are all still on B, but I would check that website to see if they are on. And if they are on, I strongly encourage you to go. I went to New York and Philadelphia last year. They're a lot of fun. So go check them out. All right. We're back now with Stephanie Boyles Griffin. And, you know, we sort of launched into the issue of the problem, but I want to sort of back now into how you and Bot Steber sort of became an entity in response to this. It's relatively new. Am I right? Bot Steber's been around for maybe 4 years, something like that.
Yeah. So we launched in August of 2016. The Bot Steber Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control is a partnership between the Dietrich W. Bot Steber Foundation, which is based right outside of Philadelphia in Media, Pennsylvania, and the Humane Society of the United States. And our goal is, as you said at the beginning of the show, is to advance the use of these sustainable non-lethal fertility control methods to manage human-wildlife conflicts worldwide and to promote coexistence. And we do that in a couple of different ways. The first thing that we did as the Institute, our really big first project, was hosting the 8th International Conference on Wildlife Fertility Control in Washington, D.C. in July of 2017. This was the next in a series of conferences that began actually in Philadelphia in 1989, when people at that time were grappling with what to do with managing deer conflicts in the greater Philadelphia area.
Really?
And since then, we've had eight, and we're going to be hosting the ninth. Save the date. We're going to have the 9th International Conference on Wildlife Fertility Control in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in May of 2021.
Excellent. All right. So that's how you did it come about. Was there a critical mass type of a situation where we had such a problem that the the people got together and said, hey, we need to structure a think tank. We need to get something organized here to respond to this, because right now it's all haphazard. Was there any catalyst event? Maybe I got coronavirus on the mind or something. But
I don't think it was an event. Mm-hmm. It was more the momentum that was growing within this field, and we saw the need to serve as a catalyst between the researchers that are doing the great work in developing these different methods and figuring out logistically how to apply them in real world situations, mm-hmm. and policymakers, wildlife managers, and the public. So there was no entity that was taking what was being done in the field and then communicating that to wildlife managers, policymakers, legislators, members of Congress, people in state legislature or regulatory agencies, and then just the general public at large. So even though we do events, we do this conference that we have every 4 years, but between conference years, we're also doing symposiums, workshops, seminars, so that we're promoting networking and collaboration between people that are working in this field and members of the public and policymakers and wildlife managers. We support grants to do so through public policy and education projects. And then we have a really, really great growing website that has all kinds of different information about this field, including a lot of great presentations from people that are working in the field, and webinars, seminars, fact sheets, and we invite people to visit it. It's www.wildlifefertilitycontrol.org.
Okay, good. So that's actually really nice, because some of the things I want to ask you about now are right on there. And this is the actual, some of the methods. Now, you started to talk before the break about the dart. And this was for elephants. So talk a little bit about this. So there are multiple approaches that you take. Some of them are permanent sterilization. Some of them are temporary sterilization. They vary, I'm guessing, on the region and certainly on the type of animals that you were trying to address. So you talk about the elephants. Let me just go through a couple of these that are kind of really intriguing. Again, this is right off your website. The Mustangs. That's why I did the wildfire song coming out. There you go. Right. So the Mustangs in Santa Barbara. Tell us about that.
Repeat the question again.
The Mustangs in Santa Barbara, what was the problem, and what was the method that was applied to mitigate that situation?
Okay, so if you're talking about Santa Barbara, that may be a wild horse sanctuary that's called Return to Freedom. Is that the one that you're referring to?
Yes, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So again, just like African elephants, that sanctuary is a closed system, and the people that run it, a really fantastic wild horse advocate, Netta DeMaio and her colleague Celeste Carlisle, they wanted to figure out a way to manage the population there where they would not have to separate the stallions from the mares. The animals can continue to live as wild horses and act like wild horses, so they did not have to separate them. And so they got in touch with the late J. Kirkpatrick, and he was the person that founded and was the director of the Science and Conservation Center in Billings, Montana. They are dedicated solely to manufacturing and training people to use the immunocontraception vaccine, porcine zona pellucida, also known as PZP or Zonistat H. And that's why they began using it. It was the same situation I described that was going on in some of these game reserves in South Africa. They have a closed system there. Mm-hmm. The land can only support so many animals. And so this is a way to slow population growth so that the animals don't have to be separated from one another. They can live in family bands as they would in the western states if they were still there.
So they're able to maintain their natural proclivities and the natural tendencies.
Yes.
And the PZP is what you said, and that is essentially an injectable birth control for the females.
Yes, that's correct. So we just focus on the female, the reproducing population of animals when we're working with wild horses. And it's just you give them a primer dose, and then 2 weeks to 6 months later, you give them a booster. And then every year after that first year, they just get the booster dose. If you want them to remain infertile, if you want them to regain fertility, you just stop treating them for a period of time.
That's really fascinating. All right, let's move on to another one. This one's really interesting to me. Gray squirrels in Bristol, Connecticut. It's not Bristol, I'm sorry, UK. The gray
Bristol,
squirrels,
UK. Yeah.
And this was not, this is not an, you had to give them the pill?
Yeah. Well, essentially, they had to create first the delivery system. So let me put this in context for folks that are listening. So red squirrels are native to the UK, and gray squirrels, the ones that we're familiar with here, are not. Somebody introduced the gray squirrels. The gray squirrels are out competing the red squirrels. There was no tolerance for attempting to kill the gray squirrels because it wasn't their fault that they got placed there against their will and are out competing with the native red. So my colleague Giovanna Masai and a fantastic team of researchers at the Animal Plant and Health Agency in UK have been trying to figure out, number one, to create a feeding system that targets only the gray squirrels and not the red squirrels, because they don't want to mess with the reproduction
of
red squirrels. So that's first.
There's almost too much fun there. There's almost. Oh my God!
I know.
I'm thinking of the. I'm sorry if it's dating myself. There's the ridiculous It's not ridiculous. It's a classic Star Trek episode, right? Where you got the two aliens, one's black on one side of his face, one's white on the other, and the other one's reversed. And of course, in the future, they can't see the difference. But here we're talking about the gray squirrels and the red squirrels, and we're pitting them against each other because of so as you described, and I obviously understand that, you know, one's native when one was introduced, but it almost strikes you as the conflict itself is humorous because, you know, one's gray, one's red. Anyway, but so go ahead. So
they're trying to figure out how to see if they were able to come up with a substance that could be fed to the grays to keep them from reproducing and therefore eventually be lower in population. So the reds have a bit of a leg up on them reestablish their populations where they used to be. They have to figure out how to get it to them so that the red squirrels don't get it. So that was problem number one. It takes some smart people to figure that out, obviously. And then number two, get them to eat it often enough so that they're getting the dose required to have infertility, and then also have it not harm them in any way, and then not harm any non-target animals that may eat it in any way. So all of those things are really, really challenging, but they have the support of Prince Charles and a lot of other people that are really high-profile folks in the UK that are really supportive not only of the intent of the project, which is to come up with a humane and sustainable way to right a wrong that was done to both gray squirrels and red squirrels, frankly, a long time ago, but not have gray squirrels pay the ultimate price for what was ultimately the human's mistake in releasing them in the first place.
Yeah, like that's an example where in the absence of a type of solution that you're working on, that what's going to happen, it will be a lethal method, right? They'll find some way to probably accidentally wipe out both, right? How would you?
No. I mean, I think they would never start even using a process that wasn't going to do what it was intended to do, which is just to target grays and to have their population slowly start to come down through attrition so that they're simply not giving birth to new gray squirrels. And then as the adult grays get killed by predators, birds of prey, or simply die of old age, they're not being replaced with new grays. That's the goal of the project, and the public, frankly, won't accept anything else.
That's interesting. You know that there's a public demand that is,
that's what's driving all of this, Lawrence. I mean, all of this is being driven by public demand. That's why the Botstever Institute for Wildlife Fertility Control exists. That's why all of these researchers began doing this. If everybody was okay with how we were solving problems before, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. It's societal attitudes and values towards wildlife and wanting to coexist with them and preferring these non-lethal humane methods to traditional, not necessarily humane, but certainly lethal methods, that's driving all of this.
The fact that we want the non-lethal, I mean, there is a positive side to that. You know, you can see why in the absence of that, prior to that, it would have been just wipe them out and nobody cares. So I see that as progress. All right, let's do one more. This was really interesting to me. The koalas. We were looking at, and this is interesting because in light of the fires that were just recently put out in Australia, where they had so much loss of wildlife, that the thought of even introducing birth control for koalas seems counterproductive, but tell us what was going on with that so we can get that in context.
So and again, this all has to do with habitat encroachment by humans. So it's not that the koalas are overpopulating per se, it's that there's nowhere else for them to go in these scraps of habitat that they have left to them. And so for their own good, they were treating them with reversible vaccines. Well, this what has just happened in Australia is a case in point of when we do something, we need to do something that's reversible. So as wildlife managers, we're keeping all the pieces together so that when something that is density independent happens, like these wildfires, we can just stop what we're doing and then let nature rebound. Whereas if you do something in a situation like that that's permanent, you have very few options. Your gene pool has just gone down the drain, and you may have very limited genetic material to work with to establish these animals and have genetically healthy and then just healthy populations of these koalas. So perfect example of not every method is appropriate mm-hmm. in every context. With mm-hmm. an animal that isn't quote-unquote overpopulated, but it needs to be managed in the fragments of area that they have left, using a reversible vaccine of some kind or agent is really, really super important.
And I see it coming back to what we were talking about before the break with the elephants, because that, and we're also hearing with poaching and everything, what a horrible problem yes. that is, that you think, how can birth control for elephants possibly be an issue when in some areas and in some capacities they're actually endangered? But it sounds like it's situation specific, right? Which is what you described there.
Absolutely. Like in national parks where these animals have a lot of contiguous land to roam and there are greenways that connect national parks to national parks, you're not really thinking in these terms mm-hmm. of wanting to do fertility control. It's in these areas where like I described those game reserves, where it really, even though they're huge, you know, from where we see things, they're still finite. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much, so many elephants that can be happy and healthy yeah. in that contained area, no matter how big it is, that for their overall long-term well-being, you need to have a way of managing population growth. Not reducing it, just slowing Managed. Population yeah. growth.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. All right, Stephanie, thank you very much for your time. We're out of time, but if you want to tell people once again where they can go for more information and maybe about the upcoming seminars, tell our listeners.
Yes, please, if you have more questions or comments about what we do, please visit us at www.wildlifefertilitycontrol.org.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Picard of All Pets House Calls. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home, would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on The Other Animals here on WWE. We're joined now by Dr. Thomas Picard of All Pets House Calls, who is virtual. I did not want to face the virus. How are you doing, Tom?
Oh, good morning. About as well as everybody, I suppose, maybe better than some.
Yeah, I tell you, man, the cancellations are they're everywhere. It's just nobody wants to come out of their house. I don't know. It's funny. For your practice, are you finding? Are you impacted by that? I'm thinking, you know, people may really like the idea of the house calls as opposed to having to go out.
Oh yeah, I mean, I imagine they would be, but I'm not. So, no. I mean, I can help people by telemedicine. You know, I can get photographs, videos, you know, through emails, the texts, et cetera, to be able to look at problems. I've already been doing it. Look at the problems, mm-hmm. diagnose them. Phone in the medications to their pharmacies if needed. This is the only thing I'm not going to be doing and can't do right now is just, you know, basic, you know, vaccines mm-hmm. and wellness visits, but they're well, that's, you know, they yeah. can wait a little bit longer. So, you know, it's much more important to try and stem the spread of this as much as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can still help anybody whose pet is sick or whatever.
Right. Yeah, like I said, there's only so much you can do virtually. I'm curious if you had any reaction, any thoughts about the fertility discussion, the fertility control from a wildlife perspective. It seems like that's, I remember we had talked about that previously. It was an interesting, you know, discussion of how that, the pros and cons of from a, you know, companion from the pets. But I'm curious if you, what do you think about that on the wildlife level? It's a different beast, isn't it? No pun intended.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I've been aware of, you know, some of these things as well. And it's like, you know, it's like, I've never been a, you know, I mean, certainly that what's the flip side?
Right.
If people are, well, we're going to go, control them by shooting and killing them.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
like, it doesn't make sense to me. It's like, if you can provide something that stems populations that are too high, you know, like deer and stuff, deer breed like rabbits.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, yeah. You have to have some sort of a measure. I mean, they closed the park near me a couple of years ago because they were shooting deer every night.
Mm.
I mean, I don't find that like to be a really reasonable solution.
No, no. And, you know, it's interesting when I was looking at the subject, is there, it's your first reaction is like, well, who are we to go into what is, and I'm putting wildlife, you know, in air quotes, or who are we to go in and try to manage their fertility, you know, to give them to give them birth control or but, you know, I always come back to, you know, the premise we always talk about is, well, we're here, you know, we're here. We're not going away. At least, you know, we'll see what happens with the virus, but we're here, right? We have some role to play in here. And if it seems like our doing the least amount of harm is preferable to going in, as you say, with machine guns and blowing away as many deer as we possibly can because we find them a nuisance, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I quite frankly, I think we're going to be having more and more of the opposite problem, is that, you know, as we encroach and destroy their habitats, there's going to be less of them anyway. And, you know, we're going to regret maybe,
you know,
reducing their population when we're already reducing their populations. You know, it's like what we need to do is back off and stop encroaching on their populations. And it's not for like because there's nowhere for people to live. It's because they want to just open up areas for cattle to graze.
Oh, well, that's
which we have way too many of anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because when Stephanie, one of the first things she said was the golf courses. Oh my God. You know, like there's that we would displace however many acres or, you know, square miles of natural habitat so that we can put up a golf course or golf courses. That seems, yeah. You know,
there aren't enough golf courses.
Yeah. Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it always comes back to this, doing the least harm. You know, we see this, and again, I know I got hung up on this word culling, but we seem to go at it whatever it takes, right? Whatever it takes, we're just very short-sighted, and if we want it, we've caused a problem. We don't care what the problem is. The problem's there, and we'll just take the quickest response. You know, in this case, killing. You know, the lethal methods versus the non-lethal methods, and you know, just to bring it back, you know, there is a sense that you know, how much of this of the virus is our own doing. We pay the price for it one way or another, right? I mean, you were talking about it a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the germination, if you like that word, of the virus itself, we're not faultless, right?
Oh, no. I mean, it's a proven thing. I mean, they traced even SARS back from 2003 to a mm-hmm. single cave of bats in this area of China, Guangdong, which just so happens to be where the grill lighter
same thing, right?
made that tore my Achilles tendon when made. You know, they trace it to a single cave. And then, you know, then they bring them into these markets and stuff with these live and dead animals, which is about as unsanitary as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're exposing people to these bats in those caves, among other animals, not just blaming bats. Bats have a right to live. Leave them alone. And, these are the bats who survived the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And therefore, now they're immune to it, so they can perfectly spread it.
Absolutely.
To us,
and then we have
among other species, right. Not just them, of course.
Right. And then we have the audacity to act surprised. All right. We're out of time. Thanks, Tom. And I definitely also want to thank my guest, Stephanie Boyles Griffin of the Botsieber Institute. Always thanks to my engineer, Jason Duffy. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you with comments, ideas, and suggestions, so please check out theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, we're going to try and take another look at animal languages, this time not necessarily with us, but between themselves. It's more complex than we ever imagined. Good thing viruses don't communicate that way, or do they? Until then, find a belly to rub. We'll see you then.